So this evening's talk is on a topic which I think perhaps intellectually may be one of the easier concepts to understand in Buddhism, and experientially is without question the single most difficult experience to have in any lasting way. And I'm talking about the experience of anatta. And anatta applies to all things. And then anatta applies to the absence of a separate identifiable self. And so I'm speaking of anatta in the second thing. So what I would encourage you to do is take a big breath. Settle back in your chair, relax, and just kind of listen to this talk lightly. And every time you start to see your mind going, oh, well, I don't know, that doesn't work for me, just think of the conventional and universal. And every time your mind does that, I don't think so, you're absolutely at the conventional level. And what we're trying to do with this kind of progressive teaching is slowly move us towards a way of both looking and seeing more often from the universal. And the only way that we get any place on this topic is by holding the conventional and the universal. And so I'm going to make kind of a modest practice suggestion tonight of maybe how to get a foothold with this, because this really is a lifetime, if not lifetimes, work, this particular thing. And it's worth it, and it's important, because the Buddha said if we don't get this, we don't get enlightened, we don't get awakened. It's that important. So, so the starting place for this talk is when I first became a young lawyer. I was working in a government agency. I was a prosecutor. And so once you go through kind of this basic training, you're assigned into different units and kind of work through the progression of seriousness of offenses. And, you know, you start off doing, like, petty thefts and drunk in public and prostitution and these things, and you end up trying murder cases, and you know, with very, very serious consequences for people. So both in terms of learning and recollection, the visual is very helpful for me. And so what I wanted to do is, like with all the expert witnesses I would put on, I wanted to go to whatever it is that they do and be with them and watch, spend time with them and watch it. So when I put them on the witness stand, you know, it's not like I had a set of notes and, you know, did I make all the points? I had a visual memory. So, you know, like all of these movies about, you know, the special laboratories, PSI, Las Vegas, and all this stuff. And although it wasn't as sophisticated then, this is a while ago, I would go to the crime labs and spend days at the crime labs, you know, and just say, take me through it. And the shows where they show that they go out on drug raids, I'd do all of it. I did it all, you know. And the thing that was nice about it is that nobody did that. And so, like anything else, if you tell someone, I am really interested in what you do, boy, they really want to help you. So it's incredible the support I got. So as part of all of this, all the many, many, many things, we would, when there was a death, you'd have to put on a pathologist, and you'd have to lead them through an autopsy, you know. So I said, well, you know, I want to sit in on autopsies and have a visual recollection of that. And at the time, the pathologist in Sacramento, and I think he's dead now, was a man named Pat Rooney. And he kind of broke the mold because pathologists, being frank, are kind of an odd group. You know, think about it, who they're hanging out with all day. So they are. They really are, you know, every profession, and within every profession, you know, there's a personality type that's drawn, and they're a different group. Well, this guy broke the mold, and I could never understand why he was in government service, actually, because he had just a presence about him that was a presence of, like, sophistication, and he was a very handsome man, and in government service, he's probably the kindest man that I ever met. So just being able to work with him for me was kind of a treat, you know, to be around him. So I drove over to the lab, the hospital. This is in the back of UC Davis. Mm-hmm. And I explained to him what I just explained to you. And I said, I want to come in and sit on an autopsies with you. And he said, okay. He said, so, and there weren't cell phones then, right? So I gave him my home phone, and he said, it's okay, I call you anytime, right? Because when it happens, right, they bring them in and they do them right away. So, I'd get calls at like 2:30 in the morning. Hey, Dennis, this is Pat, do you want to come over? I've got a 32-year-old male biker, or I've got a woman, or I've got a child. So I go over and sit in on these autopsies, and the first one is a little rough because we're not used at all to seeing the body mutilated. And so what they start with is they start with a scalpel and they put it at your sternum and they just go all the way down. And, the body just opens up and you see like the layers of the skin and then the layers of the fat and then you see the organs. And the first time you see it, shocking. It's a shock. And so you have to get through that first one. There's a lot of jokes with pathologists and pathology staff about what happens the first time. And, it's like, okay, if you start feeling dizzy, let us know. And, because it's not uncommon for lay people who go in to pass out. You know. So I made it through the first one. And then I started sitting in on one of these, and when people would ask me what it was like, I would say, if there's a religious experience, this must be the closest thing to a religious experience that I will ever have. Because when you see, when they open up the chest and you see how much is in our chest and how perfectly it's all fit together, it's the most extraordinary thing that you'll, they talk about the seven, eight, how many wonders of the world. As far as I'm concerned, you'll never see anything that matches that, So it was a real source of inspiration for me, and then a source of like an amazing inquiry, like how that could even exist. And at some level, it was kind of a level of almost liberation. Because saying that, it was so clear that any idea that I'm in control of this body, it's just preposterous. And it's like everything else. We all know that, right? Every single person here knows, you've got a sympathetic and a parasympathetic, all of this stuff. Well, you see that, and it's no longer, at least it wasn't for me, a theory. And so that was the first thing. It was like, wow, I'm definitely not in control, and this has absolutely a life of itself, and my role is just kind of like a shepherd or a caretaker, to take care of this. And then the other part that was kind of liberating was the idea that what I had seen, that my body was actually taking care of me. And it had this extraordinary biological wisdom. And that all I had to do was kind of be a shepherd and it would look after me. you know. And I knew at some point, you know, it would kind of wear out. But so those ideas that I just explained, you know, particularly at that age in my life, as a really young man, were like beautiful, powerful, kind of profound thoughts. So when I found out that the first foundation of mindfulness involves all of these practices of the 32 body parts, it was like, wow, okay, I get it. I mean, I really get it, you know, because the purpose of those and the charnel ground meditations and all of that is to get us to, I think at some level, what I was very fortunate to have happen to me is that to disassociate the idea that all of this is me and I'm completely in control of it and I'm independent. So then, flash forward to my talk the other night when I'm on the plane from Bangkok to Bodh Gaya and I'm sitting next to the Thai woman and she tells me that she and her family have established this retreat center in Chiang Mai, you know, which is known primarily as, you know, like a vacation spot, right? So they've established a retreat center there. And as we're talking, the part that I didn't tell you was, I said, well, tell me about the retreat center. And she's explaining. She says, and then let me tell you about the arrangement we have with the local hospital. Okay, what's that? She said, well, we have an arrangement with the community and the local hospital that we bring people, we do retreats, and then towards the end of the retreat, when everyone is, now imagine this, like here we are, like maybe another 2 days, and we get really quiet, and then we would all go over to Kaiser and watch an autopsy together. And that's what they do. Mm-hmm. And the local community supports it. Mm-hmm. It's considered an honor that if a family member dies, to donate it to the hospital for the purpose of this kind of exposure. And I didn't realize it, but John told me that it's a common thing in Asia for young monks in particular to be exposed to autopsies in addition to like charnel grounds and all of that, you know. So for me, somehow this all kind of came, you know, a complete circle. You know, like I had this experience when I was a young man, and then I meet this woman that I'm so taken with in terms of her practice, and then it turns out that she and her family are creating this opportunity, and I mean like a profound opportunity for people. So that leads us up to tonight's topic of anatta. And anatta in the sense of there is not an independent separate self, ultimately, is considered to be one of a few things, and some people say the one thing that everyone points to that is absolutely unique in the Buddhist teachings. And what I mean by that is that many of the other concepts, you can see that what he did was there would be an idea and he would modify it and frequently turn it on its head, which you could point to something. There isn't anything that you can point to that's close to this idea of anatta pre-existing. And the Buddha was setting the idea of this kind of anatta up against the predominant idea in Indian culture at the time of the Vedic tradition that there was Atman, which was an individual soul, an identifiable individual soul. And if you would practice, well, not if you would practice, if the Vedic priests would do all of these things and would get you into the right place, that the Atman would merge with a universal force, a governing force called the Brahman, Brahman, as opposed to Min. The Brahmin class, this is Brahman. So the idea of anatta is in direct juxtaposition to anatta, okay? And the way, just as a starting place to understand this, it's very much what I started before I turned the tape recorder on about there being these two levels, the conventional and the universal. And the Buddha said that there, unlike the Vedic idea that there was an individual soul that was going to merge and the Vedic priests would help you do that, that was not the case. There was no such thing. And there actually was a world that we all lived in, and it had a set of rules that we could directly see through our own experience, and they were rules of causation, or a psychology of causation, which we've been talking about. So the idea of conventional and universal, there's a number of different ways to think about it. One way that you could think of it is that there is, in fact, for sure, this conventional reality, and for sure, at this level, we have a sense that we are independent, and there's an independent self and an ego and whatever you want to call it. And that is a bounded way of understanding who we are. And then there is this larger universal perspective based on rules of causation, which you can imagine is a much, much bigger concentric circle. And actually, in the Buddhist perspective, like, there's no circle at all. Okay, it's because it's unbounded, but let's say that it is a big circle. So there's a smaller circle inside a bigger circle, and the idea is to be holding both of those at the same time. So that some part of us, even when we're on the bullet train of dependent origination, there's some part of us that is holding on to the idea that, well, this isn't all of it, that there's this larger thing. I mean, so that's kind of the starting space. And I kind of like, because I always kind of like the James Bond movies, I like the idea of, like, there's, you know, a pair of glasses. And, when we don't have our glasses on, you know, we're out here looking, what we're seeing most of the time is desire, aversion, attachment, identification, personalization. And we put on these dharmic glasses, you know, and then all of a sudden, it's like, holy smokes, you know, it's just like in the James Bond movie where, like, the woman no longer has her clothes on, or the guy doesn't have his clothes on, and you can see that he's got a gun in his pocket, or she's got a gun in her stocking or something. It's like, wow, you can see the infrastructure, the causation that is lying below the personalization. You take those glasses off, and then back here you are again, just caught in personalization, and you're back on the bullet train. So I want to this is a quotation from His Holiness the Dalai Lama about this issue, and as I said, take a breath, relax, you know, if your mind starts going, okay, just that's a conventional mind speaking. But I think this is a really good starting place. So the Dalai Lama says, in our own normal day-to-day lives, we have a natural and legitimate sense of self that thinks, I am cultivating metta, or I'm meditating on selflessness. A problem arises, however, when the sense of self is too extreme and we start to think of it as independent and anonymous, as real. So I find that interesting, because he's saying if we think it's real, that's an extreme position. It is not a middle way. Okay? So right off the bat, right? I mean, we're always talking about how all of these teachings fit together. So he's saying, even at a conventional level, you have to be thinking middle way in terms of how you view things, how you think about them. Okay? So he said, a problem arises when the sense of self is too extreme and we start to think of it as as independent and anonymous, as real. Okay. Once we claim, remember the Satipatthana Sutra, 16 times, right? You know, so I'm trying to fit together what, like, all of these, the reason that this has been progressive, all comes together to some degree tonight, okay? So once we cling to such a notion, we begin to feel justified in making a distinction between ourselves and others. As a result of this, there is a natural tendency to regard others as unrelated to us, almost as objects to be manipulated or exploited by this real concrete me. And so then, just think of all the times in your life where you've really wanted something, and you kind of plowed through other people's needs or concerns or reservations to get it. That's what he's talking about here. He says, as a result of this, of taking this to be real, there is a natural tendency to regard others as unrelated to us, almost as objects to be manipulated or exploited by this real, concrete me. Out of this powerful attachment to self that we falsely perceive as an identifiable, solid reality arises the equally strong attachments we develop to our belongings, our homes, our friends, and our family. So this is really fascinating because he's identifying the infrastructure, the cause of all of our sense of separation and all of our holding on as this sense of self. Okay? So this is a little different than we've been thinking about it, because we've been talking about clinging as a thing by itself. And now he's saying, well, actually this clinging is coming from someplace. It is essential that we distinguish between the self that exists conventionally and the self that doesn't exist at all, as it is our grasping at the non-existent self that is the source of all our suffering. Buddhist yogis, meditators who are engaged in profound analytical meditation of the existence of self, focus their analysis on the experience we have of me as an inherently real and independent self, the existence of which their meditative investigation will eventually negate. And that last line, you know, is what we've been saying. You know, it's like, don't try to figure it out. It's like, the existence of which their meditative investigation will eventually negate. Okay, so that's the starting place. So I think it's really hard. You know, our mind, our ego, whatever you want, doesn't want to believe this. So I think as a place to get a foothold is to back off a number of different layers and look at all of the different identities and personalities that are arising and passing away in relationship to conditions, okay, that we've been experiencing here. So, you know, the first time that the idea that, there would be a body and there would be multiple personalities or identities of it, the first time it really got some public interest was in 1953, and there was a movie called The Three Faces of Eve with Joanna Woodward, and Joanna Woodward won an Academy Award for it, and the movie didn't win an Academy Award, it won nothing, but she did. And so there were three personalities or identities. There was Eve White, Eve Black, and Jane. Plain Jane, I guess. So Eve White was, as they describe it, if you go up on the internet, Eve White was the submissive, faithful housewife. Eve Black was just the reverse. She was the rebellious woman who actually hated her husband and loved to drink and dance with other men. And Jane, who it took a long time, it's kind of like Dharma work, took a long time for Jane to come out of hiding, was actually the one balanced personality. And when the therapist figured out that there was a Jane, that's who they started talking to. And that was eventually how they created a single personality. Okay? So, everybody knows Serena Williams? You know, the Williams sisters, Serena takes a different idea of how to deal with multiple personalities other than going into therapy. So I saw this doc, and Serena's, you know, the buffed up one, right? You know, so she's just an animal. It's incredible. So I saw this documentary on the two sisters. It's really fascinating, and you know, they're deeply devout Christians, and they do a lot of tournaments and donate a lot of money to Christian causes, big deal. I mean, predominant thing in their life. So they're showing her and her sister, who still live together, you know, they're inseparable, and she's on the phone, and she's trying to set up some parties and stuff, and because she's so well-known, you know, if she calls any place and says, hi, this is Serena Williams, you know, it's like she can't even, right? It's like, oh, Serena Williams, you know. So she has all of these different names that she uses. You know, so she'll call, you know, this place, and she'll use this name, and she'll call this, and she'll use it. So somehow the interviewer gets over and says, well, Serena, you know, tell me about, like, that that personality that manifests itself sometimes on the tennis court when you get upset. And it's great. She goes, oh. You mean Tawanda? And I don't remember what the name is. I'm using Tawanda, but it's, you know, it's some native African kind of sounding name. She goes, oh, you mean Tawanda. And so then this is so fantastic. So then they flash over and they show these scenes of Serena Williams getting upset on the court. And, you know, I've watched a number of matches with her, and I've seen matches when she's been upset, and you know, she gets pretty aggressive, but I mean, this is, talk about the bullet train and not stopping. I mean, this has gone to another universe. I mean, she is so angry that she can't control herself, and she starts to get obscene, and she starts to get personal, and she starts to get nasty. I mean, it's something. You know, so so she's sitting there watching the monitor, and you know, like, not getting upset at all, you know, just watching this, and the interviewer says something like, well, what do you have to say about that? And she says, that Tawanda is not a Christian girl. So it's like, I'm not even going to take responsibility for it, right? It's like, I don't know who that is, you know? And so, but I think, at least I can, I think all of us can kind of relate to this. And, you know, if you just step back for a second, and, you know, we're so conditioned to think of this as just mind states, but they actually are personalities where, you know, I gave the illustration the other day where, you know, I was so, I was kind of narcissistically in love with my body until I was 50, and then, you know, everything started to change, and I'd look in the mirror, and I'd have a little voice that would, you know, a deprecating voice. And so, I mean, like, that absolutely is an identity that followed me around. It wasn't just a state of mind. I mean, it was absolutely an identity. It was, I think, verging on a personality. And if I wasn't careful, it really hurt me. You know, it really hurt me. Really, really kind of take me down. And if I hadn't had enough sleep, and I didn't, you know, I wasn't in balance, and I went in and looked in the mirror, and whoever that was, I should make up a name now, an Italian name, Giovanni. You know, it would be enough to kind of take me down, and it'd take me most of the day to kind of like get back from that. So, and I think all of us can relate to that. You know, all of us have something like this. You know, we're the person who isn't attractive, or we're the person who's incompetent, or there's a lot in the interviews of the person who doesn't think that they can do it right, or they're afraid they can't do it right, or the person who believes that if anybody actually knew who I am, you know, it would be disastrous. You know, there's under the right circumstances, I turn into the sad person or the depressed person, or I turn into the euphoric person. And then we have roles, which I also think are identities and verge on personalities, where, you know, I'm a father, or I'm a brother, or I'm a son, or I'm a grandfather. And in all of these different things, to some degree, I actually act differently. I act a little bit differently. You know, I take on certain traits and qualities. And you probably noticed it, that even during our interviews, that people will raise a certain topic, or John or I will ask a certain question, and almost instantaneously, people's body posture will change, their register on their voice will change, the way they're holding their face, the way they're speaking. And I'm sure you know people who, when they get threatened, you know, become like a little person. You know, they fall into being a little girl or a little boy who's threatened. So, you know, if we think of it that way in relationship to the self, and that all of that is conditioned on circumstances, that those appear completely in relationship to circumstances and then disappear, and when they're gone, you know, it's like they've disappeared. You know, the idea that, well, there's a self that arises and disappears and a self that arises and it's not permanent, you know, we can start getting into the neighborhood. And everyone, when they arrived, had a little amulet in their room, right? Mm-hmm. Okay. So these amulets are from the 2007 pilgrimage. Okay. And I purchased these outside of Srivasti, the park there at Srivasti. And at that time, there's two entrances to this big park, and the one that they were had open at the time has a kind of a big dirt gravel parking lot. Now they make you drive around to the far side, and all the buses have to line up alongside of the road. It's a mess. And I think the reason they do that, their idea was, is maybe that was going to dampen down on all of the people who were selling things and all the beggars, which, of course, didn't work, you know. So we've spent all morning practicing at this really sacred, powerful place. And we come out and, you know, we're just kind of besieged by, it's mostly young kids who are selling things, and then they have these. Now they have them all kind of like bubble wrapped and everything. And then, you know, it wasn't like that. It was much more modest. But somehow I got kind of separated from the group because one of them had an amulet that I really liked. And so I find myself surrounded by seven or eight of these younger boys, okay? And so they're all going, you know, they're all pushing the same thing in front of you. It's not like they're all offering something. So I figure I'm not negotiating against myself. So I would say, okay, you know, like to this one, how much? And he'd say, what? And so I just immediately say to the one next to him, well, how much? And of course, he'd have to undercut him, right? So I just kept doing that. You know, and all of this, right, is like you're paying nothing for it to begin with, right? So you're just doing it to do it. And they're expecting you to do it, right? I think they feel cheated if you don't do it. So this goes on for a while, and then there was the youngest of all of them just seemed like kind of an adorable kid to me, you know, and he's dirty and everything, and you know, if you've seen Slumdog Millionaire, and it's that kind of thing. And so everybody's kind of barking at me, and I say to him, he had one of these, and I took it out of his hand, and I said, okay, how much for 10 of those? So everybody's quoting me a price for one of these little things, and I said, and you know, his eyes just went, you know, I thought he was going to pass out, and he started counting, and of course he didn't have 10 of them. So he said, I'll get 10, and this is what it'll be. And of course he was really excited and too enthusiastic, and quoted a preposterous price, which I accepted. So he's so excited he doesn't realize what he's done, okay? I mean, it's the bullet train, right? I mean, like, he's attached to making the sale, gets identified with the sale, and now he's kind of in the fog of identification, and he makes this offer, which, you know, a minute before he would have never made, right? But he's so excited to get this, like 10 of them, right? So I pay him the money, and I'm walking back, and I get over near the bus. We talked a little bit and everything and looked at other things for sale. And I'm getting on the bus and I see him running towards me. And he's really in distress. And he runs up to me and in broken English he says, you know, basically, give them back to me and I'll give you your money, you know. And at first I didn't understand what was going on, you know. And then it kind of dawned on me that I'm sure that, I don't know what you want to call it, but whoever was running him or whoever his handler was or whatever it was, you know, he'd gone back and had said, man, this is unacceptable and you better do something about it. And he knew that if he didn't, probably not only was he going to have to make up the difference, which might take weeks, but that he was probably going to get beaten or something. And I don't think I'm making this up. I think this is likely because I didn't understand what he wanted, and when I didn't respond immediately, he started to panic and he just melted down and started weeping and like begging me to give this back to him. So I finally got it, you know. And so I repeated it back to him, you know, like, and he said, yeah, that's it. Yes. So I paid him three times what he had agreed to pay, which was much more than if I had negotiated with anybody. It was a lot for him, you know. And so he went from like out of control and panicked and desperate to like just elated, right? So for me, I thought about that a lot and in relationship to this and just how unstable all of these, you know, he starts off as the identity, absolutely an identity of the little salesman, right? Who's going to make the sale. That's what his job is. And he fails at it. And not only fails, but he fails in a kind of a disastrous way. And then it turns into complete desperation. You know, the dependent origination goes in a totally different direction and just disables him. And then, like, instantaneously, when I give him that money, it's like, boom, like, that whole thing's gone. And now, you know, I'm the super salesman, you know. And I have to say, entertained the possibility that he was conning me. But he wasn't. I mean, he really wasn't. I mean, this was touching, this thing that went down. So, for me, although that may be a little extreme, the idea that all of these different states of mind that we have that I'm referring to as identities or personalities are unstable is just so clear that whoever it is that we don't like about ourselves appears in relationships to a set of circumstances and it disappears when those circumstances are no longer there. And the person that we really like about, you know, the person that we think is so compassionate and kind or the meditator, whatever it is, that person appears, that identity appears in relationship to certain circumstances. And so the Buddha's model of causation is that, we talked about this the other day, but that nothing appears, including these separate identities and states of mind and personalities by itself. It is preceded by a set of circumstances. Those circumstances produce it and condition it or color it. And then when those circumstances change, it disappears. So that nothing has a substantive, permanent existence. Everything is changing. And while we layer over the idea that it's permanent, it's not. And if we just look at like one day here, look at all the different mind states that we've had and who you think you are. And, well, maybe I'm going to leave the retreat tomorrow and tonight I'm really happy. And it's just going all over the place. And we keep overlaying on top of this that somehow it's stable. And we do that so we feel safe. Or our mind does that. So How does this all fit together with this kind of progressive teaching? And this is my suggestion for working with this. You know, through our talks and through the instruction in the morning, you know, we've talked about causation and the intention, which is driving how we watch everything, and the Satipatthana Sutra, which gives us all these different tools to analyze, and then the Satipatthana Sutra, where at the core of the problem is clinging, you know, these 16 different repetitions in the Satipatthana, and then these three questions of how we look at clinging, what causes it to arise, what's the same, okay? So to work with this, those are it. I mean, there's not like some new formula to work with anatta. This is it. And it's actually pretty easy. It's just like, watch for the moment of contact. You know how much effort we've been putting in on contact? We're talking about the bullet train and all. Well, you know what the bullet train is? The bullet train is who we think we are. It's feeling tone, desire, aversion, attachment, identification. What's identification? Personality. Once I hit that, I personalize everything. So, in this practice, and it has to be an intention because it is such a specific thing that we're developing. It's a training to look for and see the contact and what arises from the contact. We can see this. We can see in an interview tomorrow where John or I ask a certain question, and all it takes is that question, that question, that moment, that contact, to feel defensive or to feel vulnerable or whatever. And all of these different powerful mind states or identities or personalities that arise, it's the same thing. They all start with that moment of contact. And the unique thing about them is that they really are the bullet train. Because when they appear, it's like Tawanda. I mean, you go from being Serena Williams, the unbelievably, ultimately trained athlete with this incredible mental toughness, to a ball hits and you think that it was in and they say that it's out, to be a raving maniac. Almost instantaneously, you know? You guys should see this documentary. It's something to see, you know? But that's it, and that's where it starts. Everything starts with a moment of contact. Everything in practice are these, the conventional and then this universal, where we're seeing desire, aversion, attachment, identification, okay? So my suggestion is like, just to, we're trying to get a foothold here because our mind does not want to believe this. And I think if we just keep watching this, just keep watching these mind states that are so powerful that we actually think we are. You know, we think we're like damaged goods. Or we think we're a victim. Or we think we're the person who had a particular trauma in our life. Or we think, and because we believe that, and we keep identifying with it, we keep acting and thinking in a particular way. And that's part of the problem of dealing with it, much less getting beyond it, okay? So practicing with the intention to watch that. Why is this important? And it's important for a couple of reasons. Okay. The most obvious one is, as the Dalai Lama says, this is, in the end, the ultimate source of our suffering. In fact, in the traditional stratum of all of the different mind states that begin to, first of all, being modified and then disappearing through practice, and the mind's purified, the very last one is identification. And it's not even identification with the body. It's a disembodied sense of self. That's how deep this is. You know, so when I say the lifetime's work, you know. So the first reason is that this is the source of suffering, and it's the reason the Buddha said, if we don't get this, we don't get it. I mean, like, if we don't begin incorporating causation and this universal view. And if we don't see causation, we do not see attachment and identification. If we don't see contact and causation, we do not see anatta. If we do not see contact and causation, we end up being like William the prisoner, sitting on the edge of our bunk, waiting for something to do and not understanding the world around us or how to live in it with some peace. Okay? So that's the first reason. The second reason is that, you know, in the end, we're not just training just to eliminate our suffering today. This is a training ground for our death. You know, practices the first foundation of mindfulness. There's what, 14, 16 charnel ground practices. So, you know, the Dalai Lama, I wish I would have brought the quote, but it's a beautiful quote where he basically said, all of us would like to die a peaceful life. But in order to die a peaceful life, we have to begin, in order to die a peaceful death, we have to begin living a peaceful life. And to live a peaceful life, we have to begin, and then he lists off taking all these things on. You know. So, in addition to being a training for our suffering, this is absolutely a training about the final chapter of our life and being able to die with an open heart, to being able to die without anxiety and fear, to be able to open our heart to our death and embrace it. You know? So, this is a quotation from Ajahn Kandasari, who is a Theravadan nun. And she says, no matter how skilled we become at cooking or giving Dharma talks, or at meditation, no matter how brilliant we are at chanting, at being able to remember all of the chants by heart, no matter how accomplished we become at anything, sooner or later, we're going to lose it all. I'm not saying that we shouldn't do these things, but we need to keep in mind that no matter how good we are at any of them, in due course, we're going to have to experience the lessening of these abilities. Little by little, things are going to change until the final relinquishment of this mortal existence. And we don't have any choice about that. But we do have a choice as to how we approach it. If we cultivate mindfulness, patience, sweetness of heart, these will serve us well at the moment of our death. And there are things we can be doing here in the monastery that we can be in preparation for that day. Ajahn Chah used to say that you come to a monastery to live here to die. In a sense, that's what we've come here for. Not that it's going to happen immediately, but we can practice dying to each moment. Letting go of each moment. In this way, we prepare ourselves slowly for the final big one. The final letting go. Sir, I really love this because it's just so humble. So common, right? It's like, no, it's going to happen to all of us. And this really is what it's about. Like, we keep talking about letting go. Like, no, it's like part of what we want to let go are the idea of an independent self and all these identities and to see how unstable they are. So, so that's the second reason. The third reason is pretty close to this one. But it's so we can be with the people that we love, our friends, our Sangha members who are dying, and that we can actually be there for them as a resource, and to be there with an open heart, not to be frightened, not to be anxious. So I'm just going to close with a real short, hopefully a short story about the pilgrimage that we just came back from. And the Varanasi is the city that all of us have seen pictures of these the people doing puja in the river, in the Ganges, the various places. And the place where it is most famous for that and where there are what they call the burning ghats are in Varanasi. And the ghat is a term just for the side of the river of the Ganges that has been cemented. And then a burning ghat is the part where they do the cremation. So the biggest, most famous burning ghat is in Varanasi and is about 300 yards, 400 yards from the hotel where we stay. So you can just come out and walk down and go there. So this last time I spent lots of time. It's like one of the biggest things for me on this trip is just going down there and spending time. And I was really fortunate that I hooked up with a young man there who we really hit it off. And you know, I talked to him about my practice and who I was and our group and what have you. And so he made sure that I and then a number of us were able to get into places that basically you normally aren't allowed. So one of the two nights that I was down there, I was by myself, and I get there, and there's this whole group of men at nighttime who are kind of almost acting as a barrier to get past a certain part of the grounds. And they said, you know, you can't go any further. And so I was just waiting, and then he saw me, and he came down and got me, and then he brought me back up where, like, the eternal flame is, this flame, people say, has been burning for over 3,000 years, and it's been tended by the same family who has been doing these cremations generation after generation. And so he took me back, and he started introducing me to people, and, you know, after a couple of hours of just sitting back there and watching, and the way this is set up is that there's the water, and then there are basically three mud layers, and where the body is brought it depends on your caste or status in society. And then up in the back, there's kind of a VIP section where people of real stature are cremated. So on this particular night, they had a full house. The number of spots that are available for cremations is maybe 26 places. And not only were they all burning, but people were just lined up. It was amazing, you know, just lined up all the way back into the city. And so the procedure is that the family cleans the body, oils the body, and then wraps it. And then they bring it in, you know, on their shoulders and go down to the water. And they take off the ceremonial wrapping. You can tell the status of the person by the ceremonial wrapping. You can tell whether it's a male or a female. And they put it in the water, and they call that a washing, the final washing of the body. Being in the Ganges River is the most sacred thing. And Hindus believe that if you can die and be cremated there, that you are guaranteed a favorable rebirth. And in order to be cremated there, your body has to be brought there and burned within 24 hours of death. So all along in the back, there's all these kind of little ramshackle places, and actually what they are is little hospices and people waiting to die, you know, towards the end of their death. So there's this whole kind of procession of bodies, and then a spot will open up, and they'll go down and get the body, and then there's delete, there's untouchables are the one who are doing the sacred thing, and they create a specific funeral pyre. And they put the body on top of the funeral pyre. And then the oldest male of the family, which can be a son, a brother, it could be a cousin, but it has to be the oldest male, earlier in the day in the back has their head shaved. And then they wear kind of what looks like a loincloth, you know, like the pictures of Gandhi, you know. And then the body is put on the top, and there's a ceremonial thing where they circle the body so many times both ways, and then they light underneath the funeral pyre. And then all of the males are engaged in kind of getting this fire going. And then you sit with the body. So at some point, this young man who's kind of shepherding me comes over and says, in broken English, I want to introduce you to somebody. And I have no idea where he's taking me. And he takes me over and introduces me to a young man that is in one of these loincloths and shaved head. And it's the son of a woman that's being cremated. And he introduces me, and this young man asks me to sit with his family during the cremation. So I sit down, and the body is, you know, from here to Everett. You know, I mean, it's like 10 feet. And so it takes about 2 hours, between 2 to 3 hours, depending on the size of the body, for it to burn and turn into bones. And, you know, they're kind of punching it, making sure it's burning. And then what happens at the end is that everything is burned off of the bones, and there is a full intact head there, skull. And the oldest male takes a stick or a rod that's, I don't know, about this big, and it's about 5 feet high. And they go over and they hit that skull and crack it open. And it's kind of an extraordinary thing to see, you know, when you realize what's happening. Because in this case, this is this young man cracking open his mother's skull. And they believe that this is like the final act, that with the skull opening up, the spirit is released. And then that's it. It's like everybody gets up and leaves. You know, it's not like, well, you know, let's stick around and, you know, watch the rest of it until it's, you know, all completely burnt. Let's stick around and put the ashes together. It's like, once that happens, it's like, okay, you know, we've been here, we've honored our mother, whoever's passed, and it's time to go, and then they leave. So I watched this that night. I probably watched this 7 or 8 times. And then the other night, I saw it on a number of occasions. And it had this, like, really profound, just, I don't even know how to explain what a profound effect it had on me. And the way that I interpreted watching this, because most of the people who were there are men. Culturally, the way this is, there's a place in the back, there's a waiting area for women. But there are women, there's not many. And, but with this family that I was with, there were 2 women and the rest were men. Nobody's crying. I mean, everybody's very intent on a transformation that's taking place. You know, this final transformation, whatever it is, however you understand it. And it was very clear to me that that a premise of this was that the people watching this and participating in it were more concerned about the suffering of their beloved than they were about their own suffering. Not that they weren't suffering. You know, certainly they were suffering. But what was dominating was my concern for the suffering of my loved one and the release of my loved one from that suffering. And that was completely second. That completely dominated, and my individual suffering was completely secondary to that. And so I think this is a true interpretation, an accurate interpretation of what's happening there and what I saw. And that idea to me is like transformational, it's healing, it's aspirational, it's inspirational, it's extraordinary. And it's certainly what I aspire to, and what I think this practice of ultimately seeing anatta allows us potentially to do. That we can actually be right close and in the face of the thing which is most threatening to us and not be frightened. That we can actually be concerned about the suffering of a Sangha member or a family member or a close friend, and that concern is greater than my concern. And if that's the case, that allows me to settle in a way and be present that I don't think you can be present in any other way. So I think that anatta has these three big purposes. One is to help us address our own suffering. Secondly, to help us prepare for our own death, to live a good life and to live a good death. And then to be with the suffering and the dying of people that we care about, you know. So, wow. You know, I mean, like, if this practice could help us with those three things, I mean, that's pretty extraordinary, you know. It's like a beautiful practice if we can hold that as the intention. So now that's what I try to hold on to. That's the big circle or the glasses for me. That's it. That's, you know, every time I start to freeze up or what have you, I that's where I go. I remember that night in India. You know, it informs everything. So, okay, so we'll sit for just a moment.